go.
Sniper arrow on the guard.
It strikes true, the guard drops.
I move to the doorway, detect traps.
None detected.
I enter.
Left flank.
Right!
One hobgoblin facing east.
Backstab.
Double damage. Critical hit, he's dead. Footsteps behind the door to the north.
I notch two arrows.
I climb the walls to get above the door.
Five goblins enter from the north.
I fire.
Both arrows hit.
Cleave!
You kill one and wound another.
I drop on the last one and grapple.
You got hold of him.
This one is for Crouton.
With his dying breath, he utters,
"The Dark Lord will kill you all."
Wait, these things can talk? I want two taken alive. I want to try something.
Welcome to Let's Roll, the show where we discuss various role-playing games with guests and fellow tabletop gamers. I'm Siskoid, and today we're looking at Chaosium's Call of Cthulhu, a, or perhaps the, classic horror role-playing game. It certainly dominated the 80s before the World of Darkness came in with Vampire the Masquerade. And to discuss this one, I went for one of the most experienced game masters I know, or... seems to me, making his Fire and Water debut, Ian Fletcher, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Siskoid.
I don't know, I sold you as some sort of expert, but what is your general experience with RPGs? Where does it start for you? Where are you now? Because we've been talking on online about various role-playing games, and you seem to have a very wide experience when it comes to this.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's funny. My role-playing experience actually starts before I found any role-playing games. My friends and I would play superheroes, you know, just as an evolution of our, you know, sort of childhood games. And after a while, we all kind of naturally said, like, we wanted what we were playing in one session to kind of evolve into the next. And lo and behold, later that summer, my one friend found Advanced Marvel Superheroes. This would have been in the late 80s, I think we found it. It was around junior high for me. And that's when I started role-playing. 35 years ago, with no gaps. I've basically been role-playing since the day I started, like since the day I found it, and have never stopped. Through life, through jobs, through children, through marriage. It's been a constant in my life since. And for most of that, been a game master, more than a player, I would say.
Yeah, we share that experience. There's just maybe, there is a game master brain,
yes,
maybe, and a player brain, and you can be both, but there seems to be a preference. I don't know if that's a common experience, but it's certainly many people that I've spoken to. When you're in that mode, when you're in that role, you know, you're always in that role, it seems.
Yeah, and I think there's an element of it where you start knowing how to do this and you learn the tricks on running a good game. And when you're in a game where you see somebody needs some help, you can't help but make a couple of suggestions. And then before you know it, they're like, "Well, why don't you run it? I want to play anyways." And before you know it, you volunteered to be a GM again.
Yeah, that's kind of how it happens. So you've played a variety of games. You've run games at conventions. You've mm-hmm. written for some games as well.
Yes, that's correct. I have a published supplement for Classic Fantasy, which is a line emulating classic D&D under Design Mechanism's Mithras RPG, which is an evolution of RuneQuest before Chaosium actually pulled RuneQuest back to themselves. So that's my published adventure. I've got others in the works, but that's the one I've got out in the market right now.
And today we're specifically talking about Call of Cthulhu. Mm-hmm. So is this a game that, well, I imagine it's a game that you've played or run. You know, what is your history with this game?
Played and run this one. I was introduced to it back in the 1990s. One of my friends showed up with a dog-eared paperback copy of some of Lovecraft's works, and he carried this thing around like it was a Bible for about 2 weeks, just reading it. And he would quote from it, and there's lots of interesting prose coming out of it. And then, you know, he's a fellow gamer, so suddenly an RPG shows up called Call of Cthulhu. We made characters, we played a few sessions, and he decided that we didn't get it. I think he was right.
No, probably.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, I think I made a stuntman because he said, you know, it's set in the 20s. And for me, when I thought of the 20s, I thought of classical movies because I was studying classical movies in high school at the time. And so I was like, well, how about a stuntman? That sounds useful. And none of us really knew what to do. We didn't really understand the genre because the only person who read Lovecraft's works was the Game Master. And at someone, he just threw up his hands in despair and said, none of you are mature enough to play this. And we moved on to something else.
He did not appreciate your Buster Keaton character.
No, he didn't. Say, like it wasn't a matter, I think, of we were doing the wrong thing or he was doing the wrong thing. It was a matter of none of us. We didn't have that session zero to really understand what the genre is about. And I don't think in that era there were a lot of movies that really did a Lovecraftian kind of horror. That was like the late 80s, early 90s for high school for me. And, you know, horror movies were either all like blood and guts and gore or very early suspense stuff. There wasn't much in that genre to emulate.
Lovecraft is still not a pool of stories that comes across easily on screen. So there are very few movies that you could even say have a Lovecraft vibe, but even fewer that are actually based on his works. And so have you eventually, did you gravitate towards Lovecraft, the writing itself?
A bit. I came back to Call of Cthulhu, the game, in the 2000s. They brought out a D20 version,
right,
which I picked up because I was fed up with the system behind Vampire. And I thought, let's do something that's the same system as my D&D players. And when I read through it, I came across a concept in the book that said, knowledge is radioactive in the Cthulhu mythos. And that interested me enough to actually pick up some of Lovecraft's work and start reading it. So I did eventually go on to become at least a reader of Lovecraft's works. If not, I wouldn't call it myself an enthusiast. I wouldn't say he's my favorite author, but I got more familiarity with his works for sure over time.
I still haven't read any Lovecraft, to tell you the truth. And of course, we're not going to talk a whole lot about that fiction itself because, well, first of all, Lovecraft is a problematic figure at best as a person. The people who created the game don't share his opinions outside of what's happening in the stories. You know, they adapted the stories into a system, and that's what we're really going to be talking about. I guess my copy, my first product was, I got fourth edition here. So I got that. It came out in 89. So that's about the time where I got it, 90, 91 or something.
Yeah.
And I haven't run it with the actual rules is the thing. I have run a lot of adventures, mostly as what I would call devastating one-shots, but using other rule sets and merely importing maybe the sanity rules as an extra threat in there. I've run all the adventures in Strange Aeons, for example, which is a product that has Lovecraft in a variety of times, Elizabethan England, Spanish Inquisition. There's a moon base in the future, and then some more traditional ones as well. And I've also run a lot of non-mythos adventures that you can find in Blood Brothers 1 and 2, a couple books I really enjoy. But they're not, I mean, they use the system, but they're not part of the, they're not really Call of Cthulhu, are they? So to tell people a bit what it is, Call of Cthulhu is a horror role-playing game based on H.P. Lovecraft's story of the same name and the associated Cthulhu mythos. The game was designed by Peter Sanderson, published by Chaosium Games, and first released in 1981. It's on its seventh edition now. It's also been done in different with different systems, like you said, D20, but there are a number of others. Its system is essentially Chaosium's house system. It's called Basic Role-Playing with additions for the horror genre. These include special rules for sanity and luck. The original game was based in the 1920s, but since then there have been expansions, notably Cthulhu by Gaslight for the 1890s, Cthulhu Now, and Cthulhu Dark Ages. There are others. The Game Master is referred to as the Keeper or Keeper of Arcane Lore, and the players take on the roles of investigators of the unknown. All right, well, that's the basic premise, but we always like to talk about how you make characters in this. This is kind of our first approach at the game. What character? You made a stuntman that one time.
Yeah.
These investigators, if you've ever read any Lovecraft or any notion of it, your investigators are far outmatched by the monsters. Are they even meant to survive?
I think that's a genre piece that has come out of the game. The game itself, I see as written to originally emulate the genre. That, you know, the original author, you know, read and enjoyed Lovecraft's work and made a game where you had investigators, not adventurers. You were relatively normal people of a particular persuasion, because while you can make almost anything in Call of Cthulhu, they give you a short list of these are the ones that sort of work better. Either you've got the independent wealth or you've got the you're free of some of society's rules, say, for example, in the 1920s, or like you're a professor and you have business investigating what this mysterious cult and this forbidden tome is. Basically, the characters, while they're open, they recommend you play ones that have some kind of easy insert into the story. And for a player, that's relatively easy because you've got a wide enough variety. You're almost always going to be able to look through these lists of professions or careers and go, I could play that one, or I've seen something like it and know how to play that.
I think there are really two major types in a way. You get the professors, you know, which can be many different professions, but they're the thinkers or the ones that are going to go read the books and get into the mythos, and maybe they're spellcasters or like ritual magic users of some kind. And then you get what I call the bodyguards. They're the stuntman and the cop and the, you know, in the story, they're the ones who provide a little muscle, even though it is not a fighting game, not at all. But they don't read the books. So I think the best thing the bodyguard can do is their sanity stays high. And then while the professors are going down into madness, they've got a support system. They've got someone there who can like grab him by the arm and pull him out of the mine. You know, it's kind of those two large categories.
Yeah. I think there's a third one. And the third one I would call the dilettante. You've got the money. Think to actually a good example of a Call of Cthulhu story is the original Dracula. You've got the professor who is Van Helsing.
Yeah.
You've got like Jonathan Harker, Mina Harker, who are relatively normal people. But then you've got the money. Think of Lord Godalming. That is the third one I see very commonly represented, not only in the scenarios, but when I run the game or I listen to Let's Plays of Call of Cthulhu, there's usually somebody there who is the money. And the fun thing there is, not only do you have a really unique input into the story, because like you're the man or woman who's making everything happen, because you can say, well, we need to get there. How are we going to get to deepest, darkest Africa? No problem. I always wanted to go there, hunt some rhinos or something, you know, and they make it happen. And even though they're otherwise worthless on the story, because you're the money, people have to keep coming to you for things and putting up with your nonsense. So I would say that's actually a very common and the third sort of pillar of the game. And hilariously, they're usually among the last to die because they've got people in front of them. You know, when something horrible happens, they're like, no, bodyguard, interpose yourself between, you know, me and danger.
Because it is a trope in just horror fiction in general, rich or not, but the asshole.
Yeah, know, exactly.
Who deserves to die, and then maybe the movie withholds that, and maybe the movie or the story, when they give you that, there's satisfaction. Except in this case, there is a player behind that character who doesn't want them to die, maybe, or maybe does. It's horror fiction. That's why I played so many one-shots. It's because then I know it doesn't matter if the characters survive or not.
Absolutely. And I think when you walk into Cthulhu, I don't think you should think of your character as disposable, but I think you should consider that they're not likely going to make it out of this, and that should be part of the fun.
Yeah. When we're going to talk about adventures and how to build them, we'll talk more about this idea of how to keep the continuing characters and the attraction there, because rereading my books for this podcast, I was like, oh, man. Oh, well, I'm playing something else right now, so there's no room for it. But it's like, I'd love to attempt like a large-scale campaign using Call of Cthulhu because I've never done it. And we'll talk about that when we talk about adventures. As far as character generation, I mean, this thing is a little bit old school in a way because you do roll up 3d6 on various attributes. But then it is mostly skill-based. Player characters get better with their skills by succeeding at using them. There is like a sort of XP mechanic, but is not the traditional XP. I mean, when this came out in 81, I think it was kind of a game changer, wasn't it? Because not just that you're not playing the traditional spelunking adventurers who kind of mow over all opposition. It's very different in terms of, like you said, you guys had trouble getting into it at your first contact with it.
Yeah, for sure. And the experience system, I think, is one of the things that sells the game.
Yeah.
I mean, percentile is like, for a start, your skills are measured in a percentile, 1 to 100, which is easy for a new player to understand. Well, how good am I at ancient Sumerian history? Well, 75%. Oh, that's good, you know, because it's easy to look and say, well, that's good. And this other guy with 5% is rubbish at it. So that's useful. But the way it advances is very naturalistic. It makes sense. You succeed on a test, or maybe you critically fail. I think there's a rule for that too. You put a check mark, and at the end of the session, you get an improvement roll. So you're always organically growing based on what you use in the adventure, which for long-term play, and I mean, we'll look at, you know, RuneQuest, the sort of parent game of this, of the system, that was really great. Because instead of just, well, I'm a fighter, and because I've killed 32 orcs and looted, you know, 2,000 gold, now I'm better at fighting. Your fighter could be like, well, I did a lot of climbing, and I did a lot of mapping and exploring, and those have been increasing. But my sword has been keeping still because I haven't been doing much. And I think that was very satisfying from a gamist perspective.
Yeah.
And it works well in Cthulhu. Even if advancement is something that doesn't always happen, it feels right, you know?
Yeah, no, totally. And, like, this was a game that had no levels. No, your hit points don't go up. You know, you don't become more invulnerable in the same way that you do in D&D, because that would go against the genre. That would go against the feeling of those stories, right? So you always have to feel like, I mean, it even goes beyond, because you can die physically, but you also have that sanity score that goes down as well. And so you can lose your mind. And so there are two ways for you to exit the game. And that just creates more threat, more suspense, especially since sanity can go up. It's heart high and then it starts going down, but it can go up. You can get some mental health care, among other things. You can also, like, just getting better at a skill, and you get like 90% in a skill, then you might have an uptick in sanity just because your confidence, maybe.
Yeah. And they also include some rules, especially in the newest ones, for, you know, if you make a significant triumph against the unknowable, then you can get some sanity back, because, you know, you rest easier at night knowing that
they're beatable.
Left-handed cult is gone. You're like, oh, I don't have to worry about them anymore.
Right, exactly. So because there are more ways to exit the game, there's just more threat, more suspense, and I think that's one of the ways you can do horror. Like, to me, something like Buffy the Vampire Slayer, which has a lot in common with this in the sense that there are professor characters that, you know, go to the library, look through books, find the answers. That's kind of part of Call of Cthulhu as well. But Call of Cthulhu doesn't have a slayer character who can destroy the demons.
Or if they did, there would be something so awful with them that eventually you would regret even being a slayer.
Right, exactly. Well, I think Buffy did, but
yeah, that was good. Good point.
Yeah, there was some elements of that. But when I look at a Buffy or the show Supernatural or stuff like that, mm-hmm. I call it horror fantasy or something. It's not horror per se. You know, it's like a supernatural fantasy where you can defeat the monsters. When you have no real chance to defeat the monsters, where every victory is, you know, by the seat of your pants and comes with a cost, every victory is pyrrhic at best. Now we're talking about horror. So this is built to be a horror game. And you see it even in when I look at like the old attributes: strength, constitution, size, of course, dexterity, of course, appearance, intelligence, sanity, power, which is sort of charisma, willpower, decides your luck and magic points, education, you know, for your knowledge role, it kind of decides your how many percentiles you get in professional endeavors, in other skills, that's based on your intelligence. So the fact that there are multiple there's intelligence and education. It tells you that, like, okay, this game is more cerebral in a way, or yes, everybody's got a body, but you better take care of your mind as well.
Yeah, it really shows you that the investigator you're playing is more than just a playing piece of what is their martial worth. You're going to have multiple kinds of interactions in a Call of Cthulhu world, and those are going to be varied. You know, you might be in fisticuffs with armed cultists, and then at the next moment, well, now you're trying to convince this official in 1920s Italy that you really do need access to those ancient books that might crumble if you touch them wrong. And both of those are the same drama, because the outcomes on the far end of it is, well, if you don't prevent this, it could be the apocalypse. It could be something terrible. It could be a personal stake, but you have more than just beat 'em up as your outcome or as your challenges.
How much combat would you say there is in a traditional session of Call of Cthulhu?
I would say almost none. What I found with a traditional Call of Cthulhu session is you really have a lot of front-loaded investigation, mucking about to figure out what's going on, and then maybe you have one drama point where the keeper has thrown some opposition at you just to say, yeah, these people aren't here to give hugs. You know, they're bad people, or it's a monster, or there's something there. And then the end is usually where people run out of ideas and try to punch their way out. And that's often what ends with the disaster for the group of investigators. But it can be a very combat-like game. Some scenarios are more combat-intensive, but again, the combat is always seen as you have to survive it. You're not there to, like, I'm thinking of the scenario we went through in Halloween, which was a second edition scenario. We had these basically zombie tribesmen coming at us. We beat them. But we used up more ammo, taking wounds ourselves, than we inflicted back. It was basically a waste of time for us to fight these guys. We should have just run, because we, you know, it would have been smarter for us to run away. But the characters in the moment, of course, were like, well, no, they're unarmed. We're armed. We'll win, right? And then we find out, and there's the horror. Oh, my goodness. Bullets don't seem to be doing an awful lot to these fellows.
Right. I mean, this is a game that tells you right there in the text, it's better to run away. Just blow the mine entrance and, you know, it's like, and I've had players in horror games, maybe not this one, who have been moving around very gingerly because they know the reputation of the game that they're in.
Yeah.
They know they're in a horror game. And then so they're scared of every shadow. And when that happens, you're thinking, yeah, we're doing it right. And if they go, well, I don't want to touch this, or I don't want to go over there. And you would think that in many adventure scenarios, well, that would be bad play. Or, well, the adventure can't move forward because you're refusing to go over there. So there is work for the game master to draw people back in, or to make their fear be a misstep. I mean, it doesn't matter what you do, you're damned. You know, it's like you go over there to investigate, you're damned. But not going will also incur a consequence. Yeah. A game master has to bounce around these two.
Yeah, and that's a challenge for the game master in Call of Cthulhu, because you need to simultaneously keep the secret of what's going on. If it's too obvious, you get to a point where you say, well, if there's a giant monster about to come out of the sea, you know, Godzilla-like, well, the military is going to show up with artillery and start shooting at it. So then why do the investigators need to get involved? It can't be too overt a threat, but it can't be so secret that if the investigators choose to do the prudent thing and go, well, that book that's bound in human skin and oozing evil, I think I burn it. Well, there's the end of the adventure. So you need to make sure they know, well, yes, but you know that there is some larger threat, and you know that you need to expose yourself to this danger to prevent the greater danger. So it's a bit of a balancing act that keep the secrecy, but show enough of what's going on to say it's you getting involved in this or catastrophe. And good horror movies do a similar thing where you're stringing the protagonist along. They're one of the few in on the secret of, if we don't stop this, calamity follows, but they don't really have the option to turn around and go to someone else for help. And the smartest thing if they wanted to survive would be go home and hide under the sheets.
And wait for the end to come. we talked about combat. Let's talk about the more cerebral aspect, because I want to talk about those sanity points. It is the mechanic that this game is associated with. So seeing monsters, seeing murder, mayhem, corpses, obviously seeing the monsters, because, I mean, fighting the monsters is one thing. I find it laughable that the game books actually give you all the stats for even the great old ones. As if that was ever going to matter.
It's there just for fun, in my opinion. Here's what would happen if you tried to take on Great Lord Cthulhu in a fight. You can show it to players and they can go, wow, we would last two rounds. That's interesting.
If that. Yeah, yeah. And maybe you can play like little, oh, let's set them one against the other. What happens when they battle? But yeah, I think it is that. When you open that up, and there are monsters, obviously, that your players might be able to handle, deep ones or, I don't know.
Yaki and
yeah,
stuff like that.
When you turn the pages and you look at that monster manual section, the great old ones are just, I think it is to show players. I think it is a handout. I think it is like, look at this. This is the, if you had gone further and, I don't know, faced this creature, tried to fight this creature, here's what it looks like. So that it creates a sense of dread that any of these creatures, not only are you losing sanity seeing them, but they are truly unbeatable.
Yeah, and it gives, I guess it gives the keeper a tool, you know, if the horrible thing happens and Cthulhu is released, then you don't go, well, everything's over. You go, okay, roll for initiative. You know, it's all here, and you can put the stats, you can even put them right in front of them for everybody to read and say, well, let's see how this turns out. It goes with the theme of the game, and the theme of the game is maybe a little in theme with Lovecraft's works of this uncaring universe. The reason that there are stats for the great old ones is, well, it's not my problem if they're out of your league. Here they are. You let it loose. Now let's see what happens.
Right. Because it is an existential kind of horror. Cosmic horror is the subgenre that it's usually identified with. And what does that mean? The uncaring universe, the universe is against us. Against us. It doesn't even care. How does sanity work in practice? You see these things. There will be a sanity roll. If you miss your roll, you will lose points. And these points are determined by just how insane the thing you saw is or how disturbing it is.
Yeah. Sanity is, I think, out of Call of Cthulhu, the most troped discussion. You know, people will say, oh, I failed my sanity check if they're a gamer, even if they've never played Call of Cthulhu.
Right. It's a meme.
It's a meme. It's permeated to other games. And other games have kind of lifted the sanity rules from Cthulhu and plugged them into their own games. I think even the current edition of D&D has some sanity rules in one of their supplements that, if you squint, look an awful lot like these. Mm. Within the game, they're what I find the players have the most fun with. It's not like a mental health score, like say in DC Heroes, where you'd have, you know, you're losing mind points. With this, you have a couple of thresholds to worry about. You lose too much sanity at once, you can go temporarily insane. And then you have a couple of rounds where your character is being, you know, useless in terms of interaction, but still fun for a player to interact with and go, okay, well, you're over in a corner biting your nails furiously. You know, where is your mind gone? You still give them an option to do something, whereas the rest of the investigators are going, oh my goodness, Professor McGilligutty is over there counting his toes. Great. We needed him to do the ritual. It's where things can fall apart. It also has the secondary thing of if you lose too much sanity, you just go bonkers. You're now basically out of the adventure. So it's a way to take the horror element of a creature and give it some mechanical impact that's still fun to interact with. You think of like, you know, D&D, you have like some horrible creature that crawls its way out of a tomb, like say a mummy, you know, a classic D&D creature. A mummy shambles around the corner. The players are like, we start lighting fires. There's no fear. There's no terror. There's games that have tried things like a horror factor, like in Palladium, where you roll to see if you go, oh, goodness, you know, and lose a turn or initiative. Cthulhu doesn't make you do that. It goes, yeah, you saw the mummy. Roll on sanity. Passed? Okay, you lose one because you passed. If you fail, you're going to lose a D10. And it really creates a lot of tension and drama. You have to interact with the dark things because that's what you're here to stop. But interacting with them hurts you. It's just that gradual grind before your character is shuffled off, you know, to the side stages because they've gone hopelessly insane. And it works narratively because this is the way a lot of good horror works. You know, I go back to Dracula again. When Jonathan Harker escaped from Dracula's castle and ends up back in England, he's not smiling. He's not happy. He's hurt. He's mentally, you know, fatigued. He went through a lot of physical problems, but he's not the same man as the one who left for Transylvania in the first place. And that is a common enough trope in horror, and I think has enough relevance for any trauma that, you know, the minor traumas or major we've suffered in real life, that it feels relatable, more relatable than hit points a lot of the time.
Yes, because it's mental, where you're not really feeling the wounds, but you're feeling that now I have to play this up, you know. And I like how the game says, you know, okay, so you saw the monster, you went insane, you're gibbering in a corner. Let's say you were alone there. Now you're at the mercy of the creature, but instead of being killed, you wake up in the asylum.
Yes.
So this is a lot like these stories where a lot of these stories are told from a cell inside an institution. And that's how you get into the story. You know, you're playing with that. And so you can have moments where, well, you didn't die, but there are some severe consequences long term. You're months later You know, you're having to pick up where you left off, but also you might have gained, I don't know, delusions or phobias, or you're just more fragile as you go into the next leg of the journey.
Even just the stigma, you know, you were a well-respected professor at Miskatonic University, but oh, well, that was that little incident last summer. Are you okay, old chap? You know, and you've lost a little bit of your credit rating because people are like, oh, yes, he had a summer in the asylum. Mm-hmm. It builds your character the same way that, you know, a list of your scars and your triumphs does. That's the fun thing. If your character persists in Cthulhu, losing the sanity, even sanity that you've recovered a bit, it turns into part of your story. And I think that's interesting. You know, in the same vein, if your character's witnessed something like a Byakki and they see another one, the keeper might go, well, I'm not going to put as much sanity loss in this. You've already seen one of these, but it's never going to be zero because you still, you know, these are still horrifying. This just reminds you of what you did. But it turns into like an interactive story in your character, whereas hit points, kind of like you wipe them off, they come back and, well, oh yeah, didn't I like hit my knee one adventure and I fell down some stairs? It's gone. It's not, I don't think it lasts as long as sanity does in terms of story impact.
And I think one of the magical things about scaring players with their actions is that monsters are always going to be understandably scary. Right. Even if you're in a game where you can brush off a lot of damage, you know, the threat of a monster is very understandable. But this is a game where reading a book can cost you sanity. So
and worse, reading the book that you have to read.
Yes.
These cultists are going to make this ritual to summon in a creature to make time start flowing backwards because they're basically mad. Well, we have to stop it. Well, where is the only counter ritual? Well, it's in that book carved out of human skin and written in ancient, you know, Sumerian. Great. There's no options. Either you learn the ritual from there or you maybe try to blow up the entire clearing that the cultists are in.
So having to do the things that you must absolutely do in the game are going to cost you. And in a way that it's also a little more abstract than hit points. You know, it's like you don't know what's going to happen to your character if kind of type thing. So to me, that's a great hallmark of a good horror game is when players are afraid to do, you know, ordinary things. You can avoid monsters all day, but at some point you're going to go into that library.
Oh, exactly. And I think there's another neat component to sanity. This is something I noticed, you know, quite a while ago when I saw Cthulhu being played. The keeper will narrate what's going on. You've come into the dark house, you open the door and you see a horribly mutilated body or something. Roll for sanity. You know, people announce who passes and fails. And then the keeper says, okay, take a D4 sanity, and the players roll it. Compare that to most every other game where the, you know, you fall down the stairs and take, and the GM rolls, 3 points of damage. It's putting that damage in the player's hands, which seems to personalize it more. Mm. And I don't think anything in the book ever explicitly said, roll for it. This seems to be something that organically came out of the game where people were like, I'm going to let them roll for sanity. Because I've never seen, I've seen a couple of times where the DM is rolling for insanity, but it's very, very common that the players are rolling their own sanity losses.
And I think that's how it's described in the rules as well. Just the way it's said.
It like intimates. I didn't reread the rules like thoroughly enough before our recording to remember that specifically, but it struck me as like, this is very unique to Cthulhu. Now that's a little more common in some other role-playing games where the players are doing all of the roles, but this as a tradition seemed to exist quite a while ago for Cthulhu.
Let's talk about the adventures, scenarios, and how much adventuring it would be. How do you run an adventure? How do you run a campaign? The books describe the what they call the onion layer technique, which is quite unlike anything that existed in 1981. For sure. It's just a haunted house scenario, but then you discover it has a special significance, or you find a clue that leads you to something else, and you're always going deeper into a spiral of dark secrets and conspiracies. I mean, am I describing it correctly?
I think so. Cthulhu is a game that benefits from a lot of good genre awareness. Like when you have people sitting down to play a game of Cthulhu, they kind of know we're here to play a bit of a horror game. And maybe not even with just expectations on will my character live or not, but you've got the general idea. Like, we're here to get a little creeped out and a little scared and see what happens. And because horror is such a very popular genre, I think a lot of people have good inputs into it. They kind of know what to expect. And so as you're presenting things and giving them the mystery, they know only madness lies this way. But what's going on? I'm going to dig a little deeper. Okay, you find out it's a little worse than you thought. I'm going to grab my shovel. Let's dig some more. And that not only makes the scenario engaging, because the players always have a feeling of getting somewhere, but it also means that in terms of doling out the information to the players, it follows a logical flow. You give them a couple of plot points, and you can even have 10 or 15 ready for them and be like, as long as they find one, I can yank them on to the next stage of this. In terms of a scenario design, that's really convenient. And I've seen it, like, people of varying play styles usually don't have a lot of problem playing Cthulhu.
Oh, really? Okay. As a group?
You don't have as much debate on what should we do. It's more how do we do it? Okay, you know you got to stop these guys from doing something, because usually you find out what they're up to is vaguely awful, or your characters have some investment into finding out what's behind, you know, what's behind the door. Why are you at the mansion? Okay, well, the scenario says you're all here for these reasons. Okay, you've got an input. And I think, not taking away any credit from the scenario designers, I think the merit here is because Cthulhu is a mystery game with a strong horror element that usually gets unveiled in Act 2 or 3. And mystery games work well for that because people love mysteries. You know, people have a lot of mystery training, you know, be it watching, you know, Sherlock Holmes or reading mystery novels or Agatha Christie. They kind of know what you see on the surface. There's usually so much cool stuff below. And so as they dig and they start uncovering more, they get that sense of reward. So instead of a traditional RPG where the reward is, I found a bunch of gold, or I've got to the next stage in this encounter chain, it's, I'm starting to get an idea of what's going on. It's horrible, but I'm getting an idea of what's going on.
And when you build it into a campaign, I think, well, for me, role-playing games, especially if they have a specific genre or a strange genre compared to maybe what is traditional at the gaming table, which is usually D&D, you need those those pre-written scenarios to really guide you. Okay, this is what it looks like. You know, okay, this is what it is. And when they started putting out campaigns, like longer adventures, they all followed the same. I think Shadows of Yog-Sothoth was maybe the first one. It set the template for Fungi from Yugoth and Spawn of Azathoth. And of course, the famous one is Masks of Nyarlathotep. So it starts with a small mystery. It eventually sends you to various exotic locales all over the world, just like Call of Cthulhu, that story itself, kind of like that.
Yeah.
And at the end, you get a taste of a great old one, and you lose your mind for good, you know. So that's kind of, and once they set that up as a template, they used it in the original games. They kind of copied that with different monsters at the end, I guess. And with a lot of handouts, and that gives you a real investigative feel, I feel. I've always loved handouts for players, or to keep things alive in between sessions, or things that they can look at. And Call of Cthulhu certainly does that. That gives you a kind of an idea of what a continuing story might be.
And in Call of Cthulhu, like, you can almost look at that. Like, there's kind of two Cthulhu interactions you can have. There's the, we're here to play over one or two sessions. This is a fixed scenario. You're probably never going to see these characters again. And you're going to, at the end of this, you're usually going to see the great awful. You're going to be on top of the building and there's Gozer coming out of the gates and you go, oh, goodness.
Yes.
Or you get the longer term campaign where as you're going on, you're uncovering more and more of that mystery. Again, kind of leading to the same end, but the gradual growth of the story, even though you're making small victories, you're starting to sort of piece together the big meta plot puzzle. And I think they follow the same path. It's just on how quickly the keeper is doling out information and what pace is being set. And that's useful because you can even take some of the Cthulhu campaigns and you can shrink them and be like, well, I've got a hole in my gaming schedule and I need to fill up three sessions. I can grab something out of, you know, Masks or Yog-Sothoth or any of the campaign supplements, and I could probably shrink this down to a 1-2 session game, depending on how long they are. And that's a big merit. But likewise, if you need to stretch it out, it's so easy to add more content in and say, well, this was only written as a one-piece scenario, but I bet I could expand it into about three or four. Mm. Or at the end of this, I bet I could add more on and link it to this other adventure, even though it's not explicitly written.
The longer scenario is very interesting because you can give them more victories, but the more victories they accumulate, the less sanity they have, because obviously there's been a sacrifice all along, but yeah. These characters are surviving. But what they're finding out is that no matter how many times they do get the information or do outplay the cultists, or like the more information you have, the more you realize that it's hopeless.
Yeah.
That you're going up against this thing from the underbelly of the universe that maybe you're going to stop the apocalypse, but at the cost of your own life or mind. Who knows?
I think that may be something to call out for the listeners as well here is hit points regenerate relatively slowly in the story. Like a lot of older RPGs, you get like one or two back a day. Sanity, however, starts at the large amount and gradually decreases. You get sanity back, but you will never gain sanity at the same rate of losing it. So over long term, that character's sanity just continues shrinking smaller and smaller and smaller. And the interesting piece there is when you're making a sanity check, you're rolling against your current sanity.
Yeah, it's exponential.
So sanity is a percent. Yeah. So if you start with like 70% sanity because you had a power of, what would that be? A power of 14, I think. Great. I had 70. Well, by the end of the first, you know, scenario, now I'm down to 58. Okay. Well, now every time I want to roll against sanity, I'm not rolling against 70. I'm rolling against 58. And it just keeps getting worse and worse. But the neat part is you've learned some rituals. Maybe you learned some magic. Maybe you've just got better in a couple of skills, or your character has more like knowledge of what's going on. So your character is becoming more competent, but also becoming fragile. That's very unique to Cthulhu, because most characters just grow stronger universally.
Yep.
Whereas this, you get that dichotomy.
You don't have the same problem as a game master. I mean, there's many games where you start off low, and then you hit a point where it becomes harder to create threats that are on par with the characters. So like everything is like super easy, except for maybe the climax threat. And that's a problem with many games where at the upper end sort of falls apart. Not with Cthulhu, because that's just not how it's set up. Do you have a lot of, I don't know, like memories that might serve as examples? Like I was talking about bleakness as a theme, which I've used often enough, like that Moonbase adventure, for example, that I ran. I think it's written like that. I don't remember now. But the idea is that once you've beaten the monsters, you uncovered something under the moon's surface, you know. And once you've dealt with this problem, even the ones that survived, like the ending scene was sort of, you're in your spacesuit outside the moon base and you're looking at the Earth. There's no rescue coming while your air runs out. In a horror story that is supposed to be existential, I kind of like to set up these, like, even if there's a survival, maybe it doesn't matter.
you survived, but survived to do what? And we've definitely had some of those. My friend ran a session on Halloween as like a Halloween game. It was very like in genre, into deepest, darkest Africa, air quotes here, to find a lost civilization. And we found it. But by the end of the scenario, the only living character was the grad student to the professors, all of whom were now dead or utterly mad and lost in the jungle and probably dead later. And his good ending was, well, like the rest of the people here, you start living with the rest of the people in this lost civilization because you're not able to leave. You're now trapped in this primitive life, but it's better than the alternative. And the alternative was going back out into the jungle to try and make it back to civilization. And those like dark or fearic endings, people love them because you're like, great. Even though I won, I lost. But it's a fun ending. I don't know. I think when people are invested into the genre, those outcomes really work.
Yeah.
The second one that comes to mind, I used to run a recurring scenario that started before I was running Call of Cthulhu. I ran it in the New World of Darkness system, and then I eventually evolved it into Call of Cthulhu because it's a better fit. And I called it Camp Kindness. You were basically playing a group of the most stereotypical teenagers you can think of, all of whom had done something somewhat awful at school and were being sent to a positivity camp for a weekend. The alternative was go to prison, you know, go to juvenile. And so they all go, but when they get there, something horrible happens and the counselors turn into, you know, zombies. And then it becomes a survival. Can you make it off the island? And of course, in one of the, I think only in one session did somebody manage to make it off the island. And, you know, as they're sailing, you know, they're heading on the motorboat. I said this in Toronto because local for us, we all knew it. They're on Center Island or something, and they're on a motorboat making their way to the shores of downtown Toronto. And the players are all waiting. They were waiting to say, like, well, she can't get away, obviously. Like, this can't be the end. She can't have a happy ending and go back. And of course, the last moment was me mentioning that from under some blankets in the back, a pale hand starts rising. You know, I think people like that kind of ending.
Yeah, no, especially if there's not going to be a follow-up. Like, you don't want that, obviously, if your character, or it doesn't really work if your character is going to be continuing on from session to session. But if you're just doing a one-shot or, you know, a two or three session, whatever, like, you know, a closed loop, well, that offers a chance for characters to, or players to sacrifice their characters. So I've seen that, mm-hmm. you know. I mean, my problem with Call of Cthulhu originally, the reason I wasn't playing it, is that I couldn't imagine my particular pool of players doing it straight or straight enough. And over time, I've had, you know, some of these players have gotten older, some of these different players, and I wasn't giving them enough credit, I gotta say, because back in 2003... we're at like the largest pool of players, and that's why we're doing so many one-shots, is I don't do sessions where there's like 8 or 12 people around the table. To me, that's nonsense. So 4 to 5 is good enough. What I was doing was one-shots so that I would give different groups of people a chance at role-playing, depending on who signed up first, basically. First come, first serve, or be gentlemen about it, and you know, I've had my chance, you know, let somebody else play this week. And that's how we got into so many one-shots. Because we were doing that, and because there was so much variety, we had a gala. We had like an award show every year for like 3 years, maybe.
That's great.
So which one was the favorite game, favorite session, favorite death, favorite move? You know, so everybody would vote, and then you would give awards to players. And we had like a little ceremony. We made like there was a red carpet, and a band came to play. Yeah, it was ridiculous, obviously. But it fit the world that we had created in which the one-shot scenarios were being played. And in 2003, it was a Call of Cthulhu adventure that won best scenario. And I think it was one of those Strange Aeons ones, the Elizabethan England one, King of Shreds and Patches. And the players were really into it, and they were really scared for their characters. It was a lot of investigation, a lot of handouts, which I all translated and recreated because we're playing in French. A lot of that tactile effort that you put into games where there's handouts and props, that also translates as more immersion into the world, and the players tapped into that. But I always felt like my players were goofballs, people who did improv and liked to laugh, and that would break the mood. And in that particular instance, they leaned into the mood that was being offered. So I wasn't giving them enough credit back then to say, okay, let's play this game and let's play it for real. But today I find that those same players that were in that particular session do really well in horror and actually make their characters feel afraid, and there is that element of suspense that is created through really accepting the tropes of the genre you're in.
And it's funny, like, how much that rings with, you know, thinking back to that high school experience of the GM throwing up his hands in despair and going, you guys will never take this seriously. Maybe he should have tried. Maybe we would have risen to the occasion. I think the underlying, the saving grace, if you will, is that because horror as a genre is so easy to sink your teeth into, people usually know what to do. And you know, like when people start goofing around in a game, you know, they're having a good time. That's the way I look at it. People are enjoying themselves. They're making jokes. Great. Everybody's there. But it seems like when people get into horror, they all understand the same thing. If you're at a movie theater and you're trying to watch a scary movie and there's somebody heckling, they're going to ruin the mood immediately. Yep. And you'll just, you know, everybody would glare at them, which, of course, if you're in the dark in a movie theater, no one can see you glare. But at a table, I think that give and take evolves so naturally. One person maybe is acting a little goofier, but if the rest of the table is starting to play it straight, everybody sort of falls into lockstep. But they don't have to create distractions because there's already so much to do in a game like Cthulhu. You know, when you're in the investigation phase, sometimes the keeper has handed you 2 to 3 handouts. They're full of information, but it's just fragments. And you're like, okay, well, we got to find out what's going on. We got to figure this out. We didn't walk into a bar and somebody handed us a treasure map. We walked by a bar and overheard that there is a treasure map, but it was lost in the Andes 2 years ago. Oh, great. How are we going to find, you know, the entertainment for tonight? And people really get into that quickly, I think.
A more mature player knows that you can still use humor if that's your reflex. It's got to be gallows humor. It's got to come from the characters and the situation. Inappropriate for them and for the characters to use comedy, and they know it. You know, it's a nervous reaction or something. So a good role player can also integrate that into a game like Call of Cthulhu, but it can't be the meta, I'm outside laughing at the game. I always like to ask towards the end of the show, what lessons have we learned from this game? Things that we can port over to other games.
For me, the things I take out of Call of Cthulhu is, number one, it sounds like the most simplest thing, but we often forget about this in game handouts. Chaosium has always had top-notch handouts. Some of their box sets came with your telegrams, maps that look like they've been created by the actual people. When you hand those out, even though game stops because people are looking and reading them, it does something to people. They're like, you know, they just look and go, cool. And they can refer back to them. They can look at them and interact with them. That is such an easy thing as a game master to produce. And I know, like, listening to, you know, a lot of the reports you've done of your play, you've used a lot of handouts like newspaper articles or television articles. That gets people in. But really, Call of Cthulhu is the one that started that. Mm-hmm. You know, D&D in the era was entirely narrative. Maybe somebody was mapping something out, but the DM wasn't handing stuff out to people. You know, the other big one in the era, Traveler, maybe you'd have a system map. Call of Cthulhu was like, look, here's telegrams, here's maps, here's fragments of a journal. What a way to drag people into stuff.
Yeah, we were just talking about the James Bond RPG last episode, which also had a wealth of handouts that look like they were made for that universe, for MI6. So yeah, that is immersive. And I used to do it as a kid. I remember being in like 10th grade, just starting out as a game master. And I was like, you know, dipping paper, making maps and dipping them in tea or and it's just aging them and then burning them. So you'd there's like rooms missing. And I remember doing stuff like that as a teenager. But today, and I mean, that was, yeah, mid to late 80s. So the resources were very analog. But today, I mean, you can get some fonts, you can get, you know, you can do a lot with just with your computer to create things that look period specific in a way that you never could back in the day. So it's even easier now to produce them yourself.
Absolutely. I think the second thing really to take out of Call of Cthulhu is Cthulhu really challenges a keeper to think of what are the actual menaces to, you know, a player character's, you know, at happiness and health, so to speak. That sanity mechanic is more important than the hit points, clearly. Like, that's really your hit points in the game. That's your primary. You can get killed if somebody stabs or shoots you or a monster eats you. But more often than not, characters are exiting because they've been driven mad. That is something that can be added to other games. Maybe not specifically with just madness, but in a supernatural game, what if you made magic and your supply of magic more tenuous? You can throw more into a spell, but it's going to cost you a random amount of spell points to do it. And when you run out of juice, okay, you've given up a lot of your agency in the game. If you don't make it too random, you make it just random enough that there's some risk and reward involved, players get really involved with that stuff because they start getting into a risk and reward mentality. But when you need to push it, when the chips are down, you're like, look, maybe I can give up these things to save us all or to accomplish this goal. And I think more people will use those if it's dramatically involved, like the sanity mechanic in Cthulhu is, rather than just you have 12 free-flowing points to cheat the system. Like, you know, I'm thinking like Benny's in Savage. They're not bad, but those don't have narrative reality. Mm-hmm. In Cthulhu, your sanity is a narrative reality. That is your character's sense of themselves, their hold on reality. And you're risking it in Cthulhu to get the job done. And I think that's something that can actually be transplanted into a lot of other RPGs with good effect.
I think so too. And I mean, we talked about, oh, you see a mummy and there's like no effect, you know, in D&D, for example. But you're also killing, like a lot of games, you're killing a lot of sentient creatures and people, and there's no effect on you.
Yeah.
You know, like that could also be a thing. So, and I've actually used sanity or something akin to it in other games where sometimes you call it sanity, some corruption might be a similar mechanic. You could just use a hit point drain because, let me tell you, depression and stress take a lot out of you physically. And so you could create this sort of stress damage on a person. Some games do have fatigue or shock or, you know. So depending on the game you're playing, if you want to bring this forward as some things are disturbing, some things are mentally hurtful, and you could have two tracks of damage going on where one is mental damage. And I think Call of Cthulhu provides you with that primer for how mental health can work in a game, especially if you want to make things a little more dangerous, but not in an obvious way.
Yeah, I was working on an update to rules to Vampire the Masquerade, and I was lifting a bit of the sanity mechanic. And instead of just making the analog over to humanity in Vampire, I was actually going with hope. And I thought that'd be really interesting, that the longer you're exposed to this dangerous, carnivorous world in your own nature, you can start losing hope. And as your hope gets lower and lower, your ability to resist those dark vampiric urges become harder and harder to keep at bay.
Sure.
And it creates not only a health tracker for how good are you doing in terms of maintaining humanity, but even the name of it sort of works with the genre. And I think that's another piece to consider there. Like, corruption is good for a fantasy game if there is an external darkness. But maybe in a similar vein, if you've got like a high heroic fantasy, consider adding on something like glory. And instead of it going down, it goes up. But as your glory starts getting too big, maybe the heroes start to suffer from arrogance. Maybe at certain thresholds, they start to activate tragic fates, thinking to a Greek legend kind of thing. Like, there's a lot of ways you can spin this to put the stuff in the player's hands and say, hey, here's a sneak peek of where your character might end up. And here's the system on how we play through it. And players love this. They eat this stuff up.
You want to play Call of Cthulhu? Where do you go? What do you do? Here we want to talk about supplements maybe, or products we might recommend. You've looked at the 7th edition, which is the current one. Do you recommend it over past editions, or does it really matter?
The new edition is the first major update to the Call of Cthulhu rules since its inception. If you took Call of Cthulhu 1st edition all the way to 6, it's almost the exact same system. The only thing that's changed between 1st and 6th is investigators gradually got more skill points over time because the game designers found that maybe they kind of erred a little too on the mediocre side. 7th did a big update, but even 7th, if you read it and you have a copy of the older one beside it, they look very similar. I'd recommend 7th for one major reason. Most of the original designers, the ones that are still alive, are still involved in this. This is their latest offering. If you love it, give the money to the people producing the product currently. They're doing great work. There are so many fantastic products out for 7th edition Call of Cthulhu. It's on the table and players can go out to the store and purchase one. It's fantastic. So if you like the classic Call of Cthulhu, even Chaosium is acknowledging they've got a lot of the adventures up as purchasable PDFs to say, hey, if you want to play it, go ahead. And you can even pillage old Call of Cthulhu to run in the new one because the system is so similar that there's very little to no conversion actually required.
They actually made the attributes percentiles instead of 3d6 just to make it in line with the rest. Yeah.
They always were because, you know, if you think to your knowledge roll,
right,
that was your int times 5.
Yeah. Already kind of built in. So yeah, very easy to convert. And from at least 4th edition on, at least, there are adventure scenarios in the core book. So it's kind of out of the box, ready to play.
Absolutely.
As far as I'm concerned. If you say, well, I'm looking for a horror game, but I want to emulate different kinds of movies, different kinds of horror styles, I do recommend those Blood Brothers books because they're a lot of fun. There's a lot of humor in them. Each of the, I think it's, in all, it's like 24 scenarios in both books. If you want to do like silent film horror, if you want to do something, you know, if you want to do like Aliens, if you want to do 1950s B-movies, if you want like evil puppets or creatures from the Black Lagoon or zombies, or they've got scenarios for each of those. So it really gives you a chance to play with the system, with the sanity, with these kinds of characters. but without the Cthulhu mythos, which maybe is not your thing. Maybe it's a little esoteric for you.
Yeah. And I mean, in my own games, I rarely use the Cthulhu mythos, not because I dislike it, but because I found a lot of players know about it now. And with the mystery kind of out, I'll look to more modern inspirations. You know, like I consider Stephen King kind of a successor to some of Lovecraft's work. So I'll pillage him, or I'll pillage things from Buffy, or pillage things from a much older story. Because that unknown, when they're going in and the players encounter something and they go, what is this? That makes it really interesting, because they don't just go, oh, look, it's an elder thing. It's a cosmic horror that I've read the stats for dozens of times. In Cthulhu, it's so easy to just reskin the stats or to come up with your own stuff and even change a published adventure that you have. If you want to change what the monster or the elder god is behind it, you can often do that with very little impact to the story. So they're very customizable in that sense.
Because you're not supposed to fight them anyway. So,
yeah.
And I would say that even the core rules do give you not just mythos stuff, but, you know, folk horror, like vampires. And so, you know, they acknowledge this, that these kinds of horrors that are not necessarily part of Lovecraft's worlds are also gameable, and maybe a little more easier to understand. Like you said, oh, people know who Cthulhu or Nyarlathotep are, but at the same time, a lot of people don't. And it may even be not just mysterious, but kind of, it's too abstract or bizarre. Whereas if you give them a monster that is more based in a folk legend, or, you know, that investigation may make more sense to certain players. So you have those options.
You could be going after, in a scenario, you'd be going after something and players at the table are guessing what it is. But what they don't know is that the keeper just recently watched it and said, that's what you're after. It's basically some kind of shape-shifting alien horror from outer space that I have vague stats for. Don't fight it.
Stephen King does have shades of Lovecraft, you know?
I think so.
All right. That was the Call of Cthulhu RPG. I want to thank my guest, Ian Fletcher. Are you working on anything that might be public and that people might look forward to in the future?
Right now, I am working on a podcast. It is going to be called The David Banner Road Trip. It's following the old Incredible Hulk TV series from the view of a road trip. I noticed while rewatching the series that from episode to episode, where David Banner was in America was kind of actually following a trail. He didn't just teleport from San Francisco to New York. There is often an explanation of where he was gotten. I thought, it's a road trip. And that enough was, you know, and I love that show. So I thought, well, there's an angle for a podcast that's not just talking about how many times David bust through a shirt and how many girlfriends David Banner's had in a 6-month period. That's in production right now, probably ready by summer.
All right. Well, once it's done, you know, let me have a promo that I can play on this show. And so people can, in the future, people can find it. So I'm going to let you go on your road trip. And I'll be back after the break with Game Master advice and your feedback on our previous episode. Thanks again.
Thank you.
There's something like 115,000 English language podcasts in the world, and no doubt hundreds of them are aimed at the comic book genre.
There are sci-fi comic podcasts.
Horror comic podcasts.
War comic podcasts!
But do you know what we need?
Two guys crazy enough to combine those fields and make a podcast of their very own?
Yes. It's the answer to a question no one asked, so that's why we are answering it. Such a gaping hole in the podcast landscape must be filled post-haste.
Did you really just use the word post-haste?
The Weird Warriors podcast covers the Weird War Tales comic book series published by DC Comics from 1971 to 1983.
Tune in to the Weird Warrior podcast today. Do it! That's an order!
Yes, sir!
Don't call me sir, I work for a living.
But we're not getting paid for this.
Dang.
Well, I'm Max.
And I'm Rich.
And we're going to be bringing you the Weird Warriors podcast, where we will promise to make war
no more.
If I were Dungeon Master, I'd have it made.
What an interesting proposition. Very well, I shall give you all my power to use as you will.
Well, because I imagine all gaming groups to be rowdy by default, real horror It's probably the most difficult atmosphere to create and maintain during a role-playing session. No doubt this is why most horror gaming will focus on slaying monsters, Buffy style, rather than on actual existential dread. And yet, games like Call of Cthulhu do exist and remain popular, so one imagines there are dedicated groups out there who are doing horror correctly, as we've just heard. And these groups are managing a proper atmosphere, mostly, absent the usual gamer shenanigans. Let's explore some horror tricks you can use at the table. And please, if you have more, I'd love to hear them. First, and this is true of any genre that has a particular tone, the best trick is for the players to respect that tone. But how often does that happen? And yet the GM can possibly add to it by playing horror host, narrating the game as one might a chilling campfire tale. Creepy music might help, adding to the suspense of certain scenes. Disturbing sounds beamed right into the characters' heads can also serve. Though running an unnerving campaign of sonic terror on your players, as if they were inmates in a secret prison, isn't as easy as it sounds. I think when you're doing the online play and you have this soundtrack going on right into their earbuds, that may be a little more, I have unnerved some players. You know, I worked with the sound design, but after a while, they start tuning it out, right? There's lighting, when you're in person at least, but have you really gotten any real creep factor from low light levels or candles? I think it adds a bit of fun, and half of all atmosphere elements in RPGs are really to signal that we're doing something different. But dread? I'm not sure. Horror games may have mechanics to help, from which we can draw lessons. Call of Cthulhu's sanity mechanic, as we've talked about, is a good example. If even glancing at a book that discusses the Elder Gods can drain your sanity, everything becomes potentially damaging, especially the things you must do to resolve a scenario. That creates tension, and in tension, there's fear for one's character. The World of Darkness games, Vampire the Masquerade, Werewolf the Apocalypse, etc., they have a similar existential threat, even if you're playing the monsters. Their inhumanity keeps threatening to draw them away from the player's control. How does this differ from physical damage? I think it's easier to see what might cause wounds, whether combat or dangerous stunts. Threats to one's mind or soul are more nebulous and often create a moral dilemma. Uncertainty, then, is what creates the sense of dread. And that's something you can throw into other games fairly easily. For example, remove players' capacity to track their own hit points. Be vague about the severity of wounds, never revealing just how weak they're getting. Suddenly, everything seems more dangerous. The players get scared, the characters do too. Me, I like one-off devices. They can't be used for entire campaigns, but for a single session and in horror, lends itself to single sessions when you think about the death toll in horror fiction. Well, a neat idea that they did in one of Call of Cthulhu's Blood Brothers, the Blood Brothers 2 collection, recreates silent cinema's gothic classics like Nosferatu by forcing the players to write their dialogue on cards by flickering candlelight and as a gloomy soundtrack plays. Well, the player's main tool for goofing around is their words, so enforce the silence, except for strict descriptions of action, and it does create an austere, bare-bones atmosphere that can better maintain the mood that you're looking for. Have you tried any of these tricks? Do you have your own to offer? Or great stories of players properly adding to the mood of your horror game? Let us know in the comments. And now your comments on our previous episode, where I talked with Ryan Blake about the James Bond 007 role-playing game. Mr. Harry, my partner on those Doctor Who Extended Universe source books, says I adore the 007 RPG and have many memories of running it back in the day. I never got the chance to play it, though, you know, as a player. In fact, I've recently been tempted to dust it off for an outing with my current group. Well, that sounds cool. It's often on my short list of games as well. We always go in a different direction. Lawrence here says, I had this game back in the day. For some reason, they were barred from using Blofeld, so they made their own version of one. The source book piqued my interest enough to seek out some of the less than good Bond films out of curiosity. We didn't mention this at the time, but very often, this is true of Call of Cthulhu, which we just talked about. Sometimes the game can be your entryway, your gateway into the actual source material rather than the reverse. Rob McCarthy had a few thoughts, said, yes, this game was a total pain in the butt to play as a team, okay? Says, though in fairness, Top Secret was too, so no one was supposed to team up with spies. Thirdly, how old is Traveler? Even though you really need a team, there does not seem to be a lot of leveling up. Yeah, Traveler is older, mid-70s. You level up, but it's all done in character generation instead of during the game. So a number of 70s games were trying to get away from D&D or that format. They eschewed not just levels, but character advancement and told you to grow the character by collecting equipment instead. So JB007 still has XP and improvement through point buy. So it didn't go that far astray as much as Traveler had done earlier. Rob Kelly has this story to tell. He says, I'm not proud of this, but already good start. He says, when I was a young kid, 12 to 13, I had a friend who was into geeky stuff like me, but it was hard being his friend because his dad would buy him anything he wanted. Comics, toys, games, no matter the price. Despite my rep as Richie Rich, I had to scrape together a few bucks every week to go to the comic store, while my friend's dad thought nothing of pointing to some valuable back issues in a glass case and say, we'll take that. It made going to the store with him really difficult. I was so consumed with jealousy. It also didn't help that my friend didn't seem to appreciate any of this and talked to his parents with a tone I could never have gotten away with. Anyway, one week, my friend showed me one of his newest possessions, this 007 game. I loved James Bond as a kid, and even though I was not a gamer, I drooled over this thing. It looked so cool. My friend tossed it aside. It was just another thing to him. The whole afternoon, I pored over the game, trying to soak up all the details. I tried to get my friend to play it with me, but he was uninterested. At the end of the day, it was time for me to go home, and in a moment of weakness, I took the game and put it in the book bag I brought with me. I walked out. When I opened the game at home, my mom asked where I got it. I told her my friend lent it to me to learn it. Unbeknownst to me, she immediately called my friend's parents and told them what I said. Was this true? They checked with my friend, who backed me up. I learned about all this the next time we got together. I apologized and returned the game. After high school, we lost touch. Flash forward to around 2010, and we reconnected over Facebook and had lunch. When the bill came, I reminded him of this story and paid the bill. I felt like I still owed him for bailing my ass out of trouble a quarter century later. I have still never played this game. Great story, Rob. It even has a bit of Spycraft in it. I thought it was very appropriate. Captain Entropy chimed in at this point to say, so despite his ingratitude, he had character and he cared about you. And that's pretty cool. Brian Linton says, I was completely unaware that this game existed, so it was great to learn about it. The various mechanics, like the chase, etc., sound really interesting. I also like that this game is primarily meant to be played one-on-one between a GM and a single player. On those rare occasions that I play D&D with my daughter, I often struggle to rescale adventures designed for 4 to 5 players to suit a single player. It's too bad that she doesn't care for James Bond. Thanks for another incredible episode. Yeah, at some point I might maybe do, I don't know, like a GM's advice on how to scale down things, how to do one-on-one play, because there are ways to make that happen with D&D, even though D&D seems to be constructed around the balanced party. There are ways to play around with that. Mike Dynas finally says, well done, everyone. A fun episode. It was interesting to hear how this was mostly meant to be played by two people, but the main reason I'm here is to bring up that image of Bond on the back with a puffy windbreaker and pleated slacks. Pleated slacks? I want Bond to be cool, not look like my dad going to work on a Thursday. I'm looking forward to the next adventure. Keep up the great work. Yeah, Mike, I think he's supposed to be in sort of a sporty wear, you know, and in that moment, he's doing some action. He's at least in a tux on the front cover. Well, on that, the Fire and Water Podcast Network does have a Patreon page. I remind you, patreon.com/FW Podcast. If you like this content, want more like it, think about leaving a one-time or a monthly donation to help us host all of these podcasts. There are so many. Let me also remind you that you can leave comments at fireandwaterpodcast.com, on the Fire and Water Facebook page, on Twitter, where we're FW Podcast. So until the next episode, let's roll.